start with our motivation. So to always keep in mind that the most important aspect of any action we do is the motivation for doing it. So this is really important in our lives in general. Instead of always thinking of activities that have to be done, to instead be very clear in our mind why we are doing certain activities and why we are abandoning other ones. And then also when we're doing neutral activities, sweeping or washing the dishes or whatever, to transform them into virtuous activities by transforming our motivation. And as in life, we often have to do things we don't particularly enjoy doing or want to do, then to learn how to transform our motivations in those cases as well, so that we can create virtue. And just the idea of creating virtue itself gives us much pleasure in doing the action, and that overrides the mind that doesn't want to do the action or thinks that it will be boring or whatever. So always taking care of our mind, always coming home to our motivation, and making that as an important object of our mindfulness and our introspective awareness. And in that way, then we can make everything we do part of Dharma practice and enjoy everything that we're doing. And so similarly, you know, if we have the bodhicitta in our mind and we really feel that and that is our motivation, then there's a feeling of happiness and joy at being able to work for the benefit of sentient beings, or even if we aren't actively or directly working for their benefit, knowing that we're creating the causes to be able to attain full awakening for that purpose. And so in that way, everything becomes meaningful and everything becomes enjoyable. So take a moment and cultivate your motivation in that way, so that you become fully present for sharing the Dharma this evening. So, I heard the classes were very good while I was gone. So thank you, Venerable Saipel, for leading them. I was looking over part of the things that you had gone through, and I had some comments on what Purdue had written that I just wanted to point out. Okay, so I can't tell you what page is because I have the Kindle version, but it's under the section that says examples of permanent phenomena. And so he says in that section that nirvana is the mere absence of the ceased afflictions. Okay, so the afflictions have been ceased, and the absence of those afflictions is nirvana. So that may be the definition of nirvana for this school, but it is not the definition of nirvana for everybody. And, you know, in writing Buddhism, One Teacher, Many Traditions, what I really came across is both in the Pali tradition and the Tibetan tradition, there's like two ways of seeing nirvana. One is as the absence of the ceased afflictions, which is what he's defining it as here, according to the sutra school proponents of reasoning. But His Holiness says, according to Prasangika, that nirvana is the emptiness of a mind that has ceased the afflictions. Okay? So that nirvana is an emptiness. Yeah. Saying that it's... So the Tibetans themselves have a big debate about this. You know, because sometimes the Tibetans also say... talk about nirvana as being the absence of the afflictions that have ceased, yeah, which is a totally different thing than saying it's the emptiness of the mind which has purified, you know, a certain degree of or all the afflictions. Okay, so just to point that out, different meanings of. Of the word nirvana. Then later on in that, he was saying, so he also says, it is a central belief of Buddhism that this state of abandonment, nirvana, will not degrade and one will not be forced to return to suffering. Admittedly, for those of us who have not achieved nirvana, this remains an article of faith. But one worthy of reflection. 156 in the book. Okay, so he says it's an article of faith. I have a feeling His Holiness would disagree because His Holiness, and well, I think Nagarjuna would disagree as well because, you know, there's this whole thing of in the Karikas. Of when you establish dependent arising, then you can just establish emptiness, which means you can establish that ignorance can be eliminated, which means you can establish that there's a state of purity where the afflictions have ceased. So that is not an article of faith. Yeah, that's something that would be provable by using reasoning. Of course, one has to have a certain degree of understanding for that reasoning to make sense, as we've discovered that it isn't like you can just make a syllogism that's going to be a valid syllogism for anybody, because the syllogism has to be for somebody who's interested in that topic, who has the ability to understand that. Okay, but I just thought I would point that out, certain few areas where I don't always agree with what Dan Perdue says. And he's not around to defend himself, so I can say what I want. Okay. Then in talking about functioning things, he said the main function of a functioning thing is to reproduce itself. I don't think it's necessarily to reproduce itself, it's to bring forth a result. The main function of a functioning thing, you know, or the reason why it's called a functioning thing is because it brings a result. The result may not always be a reproduction of that object. Yeah. So it is true that one moment of the computer produces the next, and so on. But, you know, the last moment of the computer, the result of that can be a bunch of a mess of, you know, broken computer parts or something like that. Okay? So I just think it needs, you know, I don't think you should have the idea that functioning things are, you know, like the ducky is a functioning thing as long as it only produces a duck, but as soon as we cut it up and break it, that then the pieces of it are no longer functioning things, or that the last moment of the ducky isn't a functioning thing. So don't think like that. Right? Yes.
So something could have an effect without just being totally gone, too. A rock could, in motion, could have an effect on a window without the rock being gone. I mean, it's not like just it has to be its last moment.
Yeah.
It's still there producing the next moment of rock, but can also have other effects.
Right. Yes, yeah, surely. So, yeah.
And then something that's something that was inherently existent could never have an effect.
Right. But this system asserts that all these things are inherently existent. Because if they didn't exist inherently, then they say they wouldn't exist at all. Okay. And so you learn, you know, all your reasoning and your low rig and everything from the viewpoint of the Sutra school. And then as you go through, you wind up refuting a lot of those things and changing it, you know, looking at the things differently. Okay, so then you left off at the division of existence into products and non-produced phenomena. Okay, so we'll start reading from there. Impermanent phenomena are products because they are produced from causes and conditions. A product is defined as a created phenomena, which means that it is created from causes and conditions. Yeah, it doesn't mean it was created by God at the beginning, okay? It is obvious that the things we think of as products in our commercial world, things such as cereal, soap, silk, and cigarettes, are produced from causes and conditions. But here the word product is not being used in the term of a commercial product. It's using product here means something that is produced, you know, that arises. Someone has to grow the tobacco and make the paper and put them together to create a cigarette. What a great example. It is equally true of things that we do not normally call products, like rocks and clouds, that they arise in dependence on causes and conditions. Okay, so it should also be completely obvious that they cannot last forever. After billions of years, even great galaxies come to an end. Forget about that. They don't even last for a second moment. Okay, so the gross impermanence is when the continuity of a similar type ceases. And so, like, the universe comes to the end or the house falls down. But so that's the gross impermanence. The subtle impermanence is the momentary change that things are going through. Yeah. And because to have the gross impermanence, things have to change from moment to moment to moment. Okay. All impermanent phenomena are also causes and effects. We normally think that whatever is a cause is necessarily not an effect, and that whatever is an effect is necessarily not a cause. Maybe you normally think that. I never did. Yeah. This is true in relation to a particular thing in a particular moment. Your phone of this moment is the effect of your phone in the last moment, and your phone of this moment is the cause of your phone in the next moment. Thus, in relation to your phone of this moment, its cause and its effects cannot be the same thing. However, in general, not in relation to any particular thing in a particular moment, all causes are also effects. Okay, so I remember when I was talking with one of the lamas one time about this, and he said, okay, is the thermos a cause or effect? And I said, it's both. And he said, no, that you have to specify it's a cause in relationship to the next moment that, or it's a cause in relationship to its effect, but it's an effect in relationship to its cause. So you can't say something is both a cause and effect, because cause and effect cannot exist at the same time. The cause has to cease before the effect comes into existence. So this is very important, you know, for all the people who think that there's simultaneous universes and that somehow us and the future, you know, are existing at the same time we are now. but in another universe, or however they, whatever the philosophy is about it. No, because the cause has to cease for the result to exist. They can't exist at the same time. Because if they existed at the same time, the cause could not produce the result. Yeah, because anything that produces something has to change in order to produce the result. So this is also the refutation for a permanent creator.
So I'm wondering how the Buddha can know the future if it doesn't yet.
How the Buddha knows the future
been produced.
Is he can see all the possibilities. Okay. But seeing the future, you know, the future object does not exist as a tangible, as a real thing now. So the Buddha can see the possibilities for different things of existing. Yeah, but seeing the future, I don't think the Buddha sees, oh, okay, you know, tomorrow so-and-so is going to take a walk and I see them taking a walk because so-and-so is not taking a walk right now. Yeah? Okay. So a cause is defined as a producer and an effect is defined as an object produced. Okay. Only impermanent phenomena are causes and effects. Yeah. So this kind of thing comes again and again, and it's really important to understand this. Yeah. That impermanent phenomena are causes and effects, and that, you know, when we talk about produced phenomena, I mean, that's equivalent to impermanent phenomena. Yeah, so this is important. Otherwise, we start thinking that permanent phenomena are produced, and that or that causes something produced becomes permanent, or things can be impermanent for a while and then become permanent, or vice versa. And no, you know, things are either permanent or impermanent, and that's it. Okay, and something can't go back and forth being one or the other. And one thing also can't be both. Because how can something both change in every split second and also not change? Okay, so this is important to understand, because when we start refuting some of the propositions or assertions of the non-Buddhist schools, some of you may remember when we studied the 400 with Geshe Thapke, there was a lot of refutation about that. And we can find it in ourselves that sometimes when we think of ourselves, we feel like there's part of me that is just me that never changes, and then there's other parts of me that change. Yeah, we have that kind of feeling, you know, like, okay, there's this core and this essence and the soul that never changes, that really is me, but clearly my body changes and my mind changes. So we think, oh, yeah, so the I, the person, is both permanent and impermanent. Uh-uh. Yeah, something can be only one or the other, yeah. Okay, because if you're a cause and you produce an effect, yeah, that effect can become a cause of something else. Only impermanent phenomena are causes and effects. Every impermanent phenomenon is the effect of its causes of the preceding moment. And every impermanent phenomena is the cause of what it produces. Okay? So, of course, since things wear out and show coarse impermanence, the continuum of an impermanent thing may end. But when a pot is broken or a fire is extinguished, you know, like in that kind of situation. So what is produced by the pot, for instance, in its last moment are, for instance, the shards of clay. Okay? So the object of a similar type, all the different moments of pot, you know, this kind of pot, are continuum of a similar type. And then when the pot breaks, then you have the shards. Okay? And then the shards produce their results. Mirroring the assertion that every impermanent phenomenon is a product, every permanent phenomena is a non-produced phenomena, which is defined as a non-created phenomenon. Saying that a permanent phenomenon is non-created is not meant to imply that it is a non-existent. Okay? Rather, it implies that permanent phenomena are not created by causes and conditions. In fact, the qualification phenomenon is added to non-created in order to exclude non-existence. Okay, so you can't talk about a non-existent phenomena because the definition of phenomena, I mean, the word phenomena is equivalent to existent. If it's a phenomena, it exists. We can't talk about non-existent phenomena. Any non-existent would have to be non-created because it never came into existence in any way. Since it does not exist, it would not disintegrate as an impermanent phenomenon would. However, a non-existent is not a disintegrating phenomenon or an uncreated phenomenon because it is not a phenomenon of any sort, for it does not exist. Okay? Since product is mutually inclusive with impermanent phenomena and functioning things and non-produced phenomena, since product is mutually inclusive with impermanent phenomena and functioning things, comma, and non-produced phenomena is mutually inclusive with permanent phenomena, they compare the other to the other phenomena in the same way as do impermanent phenomena and permanent phenomena as described above. Okay? Then, the division of existence into composed phenomena and uncomposed phenomena. Okay, and impermanent phenomena are composed phenomena. They are put together or aggregated. Yeah, so you would think the definition of a composed phenomena would be something, dependent on parts that have been put together. But no, a composed phenomena is defined as a disintegrating phenomena because the essential characteristic of what is composed, caused, put together, or aggregated is that it disintegrates and falls apart. Yeah? So anything created of parts falls apart. Okay? Yeah, now you see the etymology of the word apart. Okay? So this actually is very important in our meditation practice because this is one of the reasons, why samsaric phenomena are not to be trusted and why they cannot give us lasting happiness is because they disintegrate and they fall apart. Okay? So relying on transient things that disintegrate and fall apart, that change momentarily, that are subject to gross impermanence or subtle impermanence, are unreliable in terms of bringing us happiness. So this is something we actively meditate on when we are trying to develop, when we are trying to see the disadvantages of cyclic existence. Paralleling that, every permanent phenomenon is an uncomposed phenomenon or an uncaused phenomenon defined as a non-disintegrating phenomenon. Okay? As before, since composed phenomena are mutually inclusive with impermanent phenomena and uncomposed phenomena are mutually inclusive with permanent phenomena, they compare to other phenomena in the same way as described above. So what we're going through here is just different ways of dividing existence, the big category. And remember, existence had all these synonyms too. You know, phenomena, object, established base. Yeah, all these different things. So too, when we divide them, the two major categories are, you know, we keep dividing and there's all these parallels. And so the reason for having all these divisions that are the same is because each way of dividing it gives you a slightly different understanding of what that group is about. Yeah. If we only said functioning things and non-functioning things, you know, we wouldn't have it so clear in our mind that functioning things are impermanent, that they are created, that they are composed, and that they are specifically characterized phenomena. So all these definitions, you know, all these ways of categorizing are pointing out different common characteristics of these groups. Then the division of existence into ultimate truths and conventional truths. Okay, let's pause here because this is a longer section and not so long, but it's very, very different than what we're used to. Okay, so how, you know, the Satantrikas define conventional truths and ultimate truths is the total opposite of how the Prasangikas do, and we're used to the Prasangika version, okay? But by defining these in a different way, it really shows you, you know, how this school thinks and how, you know, this school, you know, really values impermanent things, functioning things that can be seen by direct cognizers. And that, you know, it kind of says, permanent phenomena are uncreated and uncompounded, and they can only be seen by conceptual consciousnesses. Okay, so this system really values direct perceivers. What's interesting is that it says direct perceivers can only perceive impermanent things. It can't perceive permanent things. Okay, and when you realize that, you know, this is what the lower schools believe and they hold on to so tightly, how completely radical it is for the Prasangikas to say that you can have a direct perceiver of emptiness, which is a permanent phenomenon. You know, that's really shocking when you see how this school, and you've been studying this school and learned it so well, you know, it's like, oh, Prasangikas say you can have direct perception of a permanent phenomena, huh? Yeah, and that emptiness is it's a negation, but it's not created by conception, because the lower schools, again, usually say that, you know, negative phenomena they're created by or dependent on conception. You only can see can know these kinds of things through the power of a conceptual consciousness, not directly. And then here it's saying emptiness is permanent, but it's not, you know, it's not created by, well, it is created by conception as the Prasangikas define that, but it's not created by conception as the Satantrikas define it. Okay. See, there you can really begin to see kind of the difference in opinions that these schools have. Yeah.
So this morning, the Lam Rim topic was the three characteristics.
Was what?
The three characteristics
yeah.
of all things in cyclic existence. And the first was transient.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, so two questions came up. The first is, how can we say that there are permanent things in cyclic existence if, you know, doesn't that contradict with the teaching?
You can't say permanent things because thing, the word thing is synonymous with functioning thing. So we phenomena. Often say just casually permanent yeah. things, but technically we should be saying okay. permanent phenomenon.
Yeah. So how are there permanent phenomena?
In cyclic existence?
Yes.
Because the emptiness of the thermos is a permanent phenomenon.
Yeah, I just thought it kind of, they seem contradictory to say that all things in cyclic existence are transient. So then my question is, I was also wondering, why didn't they use the word impermanent? Does transient,
I don't think you can necessarily say all things. You can say all that. I think when we say all things in cyclic existence are impermanent, we're speaking in a very general way. Okay? Yeah, because the emptiness of the thermos, you know, you could argue because the thermos is something in some, you know, is a true suffering, that the emptiness of the thermos is also found in cyclic existence, but it's not impermanent.
Well, okay, yeah, if it's just a general all things, it's not, doesn't exactly mean all things.
So what exactly is your question?
So my question is, the Lam Rim guide that we used this morning, it said all things in cyclic existence, all phenomena, I guess it said things, all things in cyclic existence are transient.
Are?
Transient.
Transient, yeah. Okay.
So I'm wondering how now we can say there are phenomena that are permanent.
Okay. We're not saying that the transient things are permanent.
Right, I'm just yeah. saying that the teachings.
Yeah, the thing is, when you say different. All things in samsara are impermanent, your purpose in saying that is to get people to see that there's nothing trustworthy and stable in samsara. It's not a philosophical statement saying that there's no permanent phenomena in samsara. Okay, it's a statement to get you to think of what you normally take refuge in.
Maybe I'm belaboring the point because I always, you know, really believed in the three marks of existence. And
yeah.
So now I'm like, oh, how do I conceive of permanent phenomena?
Oh, don't worry about permanent phenomena here. Because the you know, the three characteristics, you know, as they're stated there, it's for a certain purpose. We're not talking philosophically. Okay? Permanent, impermanent, existent. We're not talking philosophically, you know. And we're not so concerned about the permanent phenomena in samsara because those are not things that directly produce dukkha. You know, the emptiness of the thermos is not producing dukkha. So the purpose of saying that the things in samsara are impermanent is to show that they're unreliable and that they produce dukkha. Okay? So we're not talking about permanent versus impermanent and stuff like that in that kind of case. And if, you know, yeah, okay?
Okay, thank you very yeah. much.
Yeah. So there's lots of things where you have to really see what the context is that they're being spoken of and why they're being spoken of it in that way. I mean, you could say, you know, all the permanent and impermanent things of samsara are you can't say they're transient. Yeah, you could say all the permanent and impermanent things of samsara exist. But that's not going to help you develop renunciation of samsara to say that, okay? And the purpose of teaching the three characteristics is for people to develop renunciation of samsara, okay? So that's why the emphasis is on impermanent phenomena. Whatever you want to call it, you know, I mean, I just explained the meaning, so I think that that's clear enough, okay?
Last week, we were looking in the section of the book where Purdue is talking about nirvana is a permanent phenomena that exists for an occasion.
Yeah.
From the time a meditator abandons the last mental affliction and after that. Mm-hmm. And then in a chart that you sent us a few weeks ago, mm-hmm. The definition of occasional permanent is it comes into and goes out of existence.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just wondering, they seem like they're talking about a different kind of thing.
Yeah. Maybe, you know, we could say it comes into existence and may go out of existence.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So that's good. We should change the chart. Yeah. Say it may go out.